the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, you know, who's planning your travel schedule? You go to Europe often, but I mean, you just happen to be in Brussels at one of the most critical points in European history in the last 50 years.
Kevin, I brought with me two books to read on the plane. One was Restructuring Sovereign Debt by Lex Riefel, and Monetary History, Exchange Rates, and Financial Markets, edited by Paul Meisen. And, you know, I'm going through theoretically what could be done, what should be done in sort of an aseptic environment. And in fact, in Europe, it's anything but aseptic. If you look at Ireland, things are absolutely imploding. And the folks here in Brussels are having to scramble to figure out what this looks like. Present tense, future tense, can the EU hold together? Or is this something that ultimately serves as the cause for dissolution of this union? Someone that we wanted to bring on the line, we've had on the program a number of times before, and from London, just returning from China, is Ambrose Evans-Pritchard, writes for The Telegraph, a number of articles on a weekly basis. And this should be an interesting set of questions posed to him, and questions that I think we remain with, because I don't know that there's answers here. Kevin, I think at the end of the day, we are trying to entertain possible outcomes. No one knows for sure what happens. There's a huge political dimension, and this is something we've tried to focus our listeners' attention to over the last year and a half to 2 years. When you begin with a financial crisis, morph into an economic crisis, and then find yourselves in the throes of a political and geopolitical crisis, when it gets to the political and geopolitical, it's a little bit like watching the football in the air spinning. You don't know which way it's going to bounce. It's going to hit the ground momentarily, and then we can tell you with a little bit more certainty whether it's forward, left, right, or whichever direction it's going to go.
Well, David, I can think of no one better to talk to right now than Ambrose, and also the articles that he's written for The Telegraph. I know that people look forward to reading that just for the analysis of what's going on in the European Union. Let's go ahead and join that conversation now, Dave.
Well, as many of our listeners know, the project in the EU and the launch of the European Monetary Unit has quite a history, going back many decades, but with an official launch here within the last decade or so. And the project, while it has political implications, was primarily a monetary union with some ceding of fiscal responsibilities, because it really is difficult at the end of the day to not include the fiscal and monetary. They're very complementary in nature. That's what we have today, is the struggles of each of these individual states, each of these individual polities trying to govern themselves in the context of a national, or should we say, corporate disunion. And with us today, we have a guest who's been on the program several times before, Ambrose Evans-Pritchard. He spent a number of years here in Brussels. I'm in Brussels today. He's in London. But we wanted to visit with him to get his insights, because as we look at the Eurozone, there are individual countries here that have issues. But the issues are not just specific to those individual countries, and perhaps the solutions with one are not the solutions that will last and create a lasting union. Ambrose, thanks for joining us today. Why don't you let us know what you're thinking in terms of the current machinations in the Eurozone?
Yeah, nice to be with you. I mean, there's a basic point here. The original sin was to create this currency without a kind of unified treasury like the U.S. Treasury, without a kind of debt union, without an economic government or a single political entity behind it. It's an orphan currency with these separate sovereign states running their own fiscal policies. And you know, they got away with it for 10 years, but finally, incoherence of this has caught up with them. And huge imbalances were allowed to develop, as you know. Finally, it was exposed by the global financial crisis. The first country to erupt was Greece in April. They had a rescue, 110 billion euro rescue. They thought they'd put that to bed and they'd got through the crisis. And now, of course, it's erupted again. We've got a sort of second wave of this, and it's Ireland, and close behind Ireland is Portugal. And, you know, what is it exposing? It's not just a question of Greece having cheated and lied over its figures. There's a deeper problem that several countries are in serious trouble. And what they all have in common is far too much debt. And the reason why I have far too much debt is the interest rate set by the European Central Bank for German needs a decade ago caused them to have massive property and credit bubbles and overheat. So essentially trying to run a monetary policy for two completely different kinds of economies, essentially North Europe and South Europe, you know, for a slow core that needed very low rates and a very fast-growing core, very fast-growing periphery that needed much higher rates is just incompatible, and it's led to the total mess we're now in.
Well, there are some similarities to the U.S. economy in the sense that we've arbitrarily and artificially pressed interest rates lower, and that is in response to the recession in 2000 and 2001, gave us a property bubble, which listeners don't need any reminding, created quite a lot of havoc through the mortgage-backed securities market, the securitization that occurred through Wall Street and various global banks, and the distribution of paper, which we've found to be fairly illiquid. There are some differences, of course, but that theme of interest rates and the bond market being central to fiscal stability and ultimately political stability is very, very interesting. So just to reiterate, you're saying Germany set the interest rates too low, which created artificially real estate bubbles throughout the southern European states. Those have since come unglued, but we've now got this mountain of debt.
Yeah, I mean, they're now being basically told to carry out massive austerity programs and what's called an internal devaluation. They can't devalue any longer, which is what they would have done in the old days in this sort of crisis. They lost control over the all the levers of monetary policy. They can't do quantitative easing or anything else. They just have to sort of sweat it out. And the trouble is, you know, it's pushing these economies deeper and deeper into a sort of perma slump. Ireland's gross national product has contracted by 24%. Nominal, and the trouble is the debt has continued to grow in that time. So, you know, they're doing the splits. Their debt load is rising and their economy that has to support this debt is contracting. And the more they push the country into austerity, the more the economy contracts and the worse this imbalance gets. So the fundamental strategy being imposed upon them by the EU is incoherent. There are variants of this going on in Portugal and in Spain and in Greece. And the other thing that's happening, of course, is in the case of Greece, where they had a bailout, instead of dealing with the core problem, which is too much debt and having debt restructuring, they're simply piling on further debt. Greece's debt, according to the IMF now, will be 160% of GDP when they get out of this, their public debt. It will have risen from about 115 to 160% during the course of the IMF treatment. So they're getting in deeper and deeper and deeper into a hole. It's not a coherent strategy. There's no way out of it. In the end, in my view, pushing these countries into deeper and deeper austerity that's not delivering any solution is politically untenable, and you will start getting serious political reactions. You'll have governments are going to fall. You're going to have radical parties gaining more and more traction. There is a risk you simply destabilize the democracies on the whole periphery of Europe in the process, which is, of course, the opposite of what the purpose of the Eurozone was to bind everybody together and ensure political stability. Is having exactly the opposite effect.
Well, being a student of history, I'm very intrigued by that idea of internal devaluations or austerity measures, mainly because that's what we're seeing as the stirring of the pot, so to say, at the social and the political level. In 2010, The Economist wrote one of their projections or prognostications was that social unrest would be a dominant theme this year. And they've certainly been accurate with that. It's been a continued theme for the last 6 months. But those austerity measures, perhaps you can speak to the student unemployment rates, sort of the sub-30 age bracket, which in Spain I think is north of 44%, Ireland slightly better. But I mean, you're talking about the roots of revolution when you're talking about young people who don't have jobs, don't have hope, and are angry, feeling that this is being done to them by someone else.
Yeah, there seems to be a sort of a pattern that the initial effect when you have a terrible economic crisis and a shock is sort of people for the first year or 18 months or so they kind of just put up with it. They're fatalistic. They accept the pain and the austerity they think is necessary. You know, you grin and bear it, and you'll, you know, there'll be light at the end of the tunnel. You get out of it. The pattern is that when you get into the second and third year and you're not getting out of it, that's when people start becoming radicalized. And it was a story of the early 1930s, that it was year two, year three, year four, particularly year three and year four, when everything went to pieces and you started having, well, in the case of Europe, half of Europe became authoritarian in one way or another and lost their democracies. That was very, very radical. But we're seeing it sort of creeping in now. We got to the phase where the party political systems held up reasonably well around the periphery, but now it's sort of breaking down. Not just the periphery either, actually, in many countries. You've got a minority government in the Netherlands, one of the core countries, where a right-wing populist now has the balance of power in parliament and great influence over the decisions of the government. You've got, in Greece, quite an active terrorist movement now targeting anybody associated essentially with what they call the memorandum, which is the EU-IMF regime that's been imposed upon them. And, you know, there have been parcel bombs, there have been attacks. It's quite actually getting slightly dangerous to serve in Athens if you're, you know, part of, associated with this inspectorate. You know, this is where it gets a little dangerous. And the problem with this is, who has ownership over the policies that are being pursued? Is it sort of come out of the national democracy? In Britain, you know, we have austerity measures underway. We had a new government that was elected, clearly said it was going to do this, is now doing this. It has a mandate. There's general acceptance. Not everybody's accepting it because we've had a few disturbances. But basically, there's an understanding that this has to be done and the country's behind it. But when this is being imposed from outside and your elected government has lost control, it's a totally different matter, and that's where it becomes dangerous. Now, we've seen a lot of problems in Greece. We've had about five or six general strikes. It's not yet out of control. The government's still handling it. It's just survived very narrowly some elections where some of the provinces keep, for example, the province around Athens, who had radical dissenters who broke away from the ruling Socialist Party, you know, challenging for power. They had a very close-run thing, and the government barely survived, but it has survived. We'll see what happens. In Portugal, there is no longer the government's lost its majority. The last elections, a lot of people split away from the socialists and voted for the Maoists and Trotskyists and communists. 18% now popular support for the various varieties of communist parties in Portugal. You've got a splintered system, no majority, great difficulty delivering any kind of budget or political reforms. Spain so far is the dog that hasn't barked. Everybody's wondering, and you've got 20% unemployment, you've got youth unemployment, as you said, is sort of in the low 40s. It's quite dire. You had a report coming out yesterday by their leading property consultancy group saying there are 1.5 million homes in Spain either already on the market or that will be completed in the next couple of years. That will take, that's six times annual demand for new homes. That's a colossal amount. I think it's going to take probably right through to the end of the decade to clear this. I mean, it's a much, much more serious overhang of excess property than in the United States, where I think you've probably got 10 or 11 months. I don't know what the latest figure is. And possibly there's some more banks and others are sitting on foreclosed properties and so forth. So maybe it's a year and a half. I don't know. But it's nothing like Spain. It's probably four times as bad in Spain. That's what you're dealing with here. So people are wondering, well, you know, you've got this incredibly high unemployment. You've got the economy trapped in perma-slump. Its brief little recovery has already fizzled out. The economy was, growth was back to zero in the third quarter. And there's a general, very high likelihood that they will tip straight back into recession in early 2011. Car sales collapsed 38% in Spain in October. It's not recovering. So now you wonder, what's going to happen politically as the Spanish public sort of digest this? And everybody in the markets knows that Spain's the linchpin. You can have a crisis in Greece and Ireland and in Portugal. You can have bailouts there. It's just about doable. You can't bail out Spain because it's too big. Foreign banks have 850 billion of exposure to Spanish debt. It's much, much bigger economy. This is the point where the EU's bailout fund is no longer credible.
Yeah, this just raises the issue of whether or not the union can be held together. Certainly there's massive ramifications for all the constituent parts if one leaves or if one's kicked out. But I mean, is it more probable to see sort of a grassroots move at the Spanish level where people are demanding being taken out of the EU? Or is it more likely to see the Germans at some point say, as much as we have benefited from this union, we can see that the ship is sinking, and we'd like to be the first off, not the last off. Captain of the ship we may be, but we need to go.
I mean, in the case of Spain, joining the European Union in the 1980s was just an incredibly important moment for Spain. It had been isolated, basically, from the rest of Europe for 40 years under the Franco dictatorship. And it had been sort of stagnating. And there's this sort of moment of when it joined the EU and rejoined Europe, and it's had this tremendous sort of revival of confidence, and the economy's had this great catch-up spurt. So basically, there's a huge sort of feeling of essential goodwill towards Europe in Spain. I mean, it's not something I want to give up lightly. There isn't a sort of movement out there sort of saying, well, we should leave it, or we should leave the euro. It hasn't yet reached that point. Very few people are analyzing it in those terms. They're lashing out at the government, though they're lashing out at this, that, and the other, but they're not really blaming Europe for it. And they're not really blaming membership of the eurozone for causing their current crisis. There are a few isolated economists who do, but it's not generally part of the debate. I'm waiting for that moment to happen, when people begin to say, well, wait a second, we're stuck in slump, we can't get out of it, why can't we get out of it? Might it have something to do with the fact we can't devalue and can't do all the things we need to do if you had your own sovereign currency? But they're not really saying that. We've had calls today by the leader of the opposition demanding the government steps down, saying it's a complete scandal that they're holding on to power, they've lost all credibility. You've got beginnings of a political crisis developing in Spain. It's really not yet anti-European. In Italy too, which is obviously even more serious, because that's the third biggest debt in the world. The public debt of Italy is the third biggest after Japan and the United States. And it's a very, very large sum of money. I mean, it's very large for Italy, but it's very large in absolute terms. And there, the government is crumbling. The four ministers resigned on Monday. The Berlusconi government is hanging on by its fingernails. It's discredited. Who knows what's going to happen? And there's a lot of political risk building up in Italy. But to get to your point about if this thing ever kind of spits up, will it be the South leaving, or will it be, in fact, Germany and the northern creditor countries, Netherlands and Finland, saying, we've had enough of paying for these endless bailouts. We've had enough of the European Central Bank becoming a kind of rehab clinic for, you know, Irish and Greek and Spanish banks in trouble and debauching the monetary policy of the eurozone. We think this whole thing is going to pieces, and we're just going to pick up our marbles and go home. There are quite a lot of people who think that if this thing ever comes to an existential crisis and breaks up, it's going to be because the Germans say no more. We've had enough of this. We're not there yet. But some of the actions I think being taken by Germany lately seem almost to suggest that certain people there, certain officials there, want to bring this to a head. And it was Germany, remember, who 2 or 3 weeks ago came out and said, well, there should be bondholders and creditors should share some of the pain. They should share haircuts from these debt restructurings. And that's what triggered this latest crisis in Ireland. I mean, as soon as they said that, there was panic, and people, investors and funds, just started selling off their Irish, Portuguese, Spanish bonds. There was this flight from the peripheral eurozone because they didn't want to be left holding bonds, have haircuts imposed upon them.
This is one of the critical points of our markets today. It's hardly a stable environment to be in when the best bet around is socialized risk. And if, in fact, the risks of the bond market can't be socialized, we recognize balance sheets for what they are as inherently unstable. Think of the construct that we're talking about. People are putting real money. The blood, sweat, and tears of ages that have gone into savings are being speculated with on the basis of socialized risk. That's our best bet moving forward.
Well, it was obviously Chancellor Merkel of Germany is entirely right to say that you can't just have taxpayers endlessly bailing out these countries, that the bondholders should share the risk, share the pain, because they've been protected so far in Europe. They've not really suffered any pain at all from the financial crisis. They've been totally shielded. And indeed, I might add that rescue for Greece wasn't a rescue for Greece. It was a rescue for the German and French banks who were over-invested in Greece. So it was Greece suffers all the penalties of austerity and extra debt imposed upon it in order to bail out the foreign banks. But that's another story. The problem is, to do that right now, when we've got a very delicate situation in Ireland. Ireland's budget deficit this year will be 32% of GDP. 32. That's not a mistake. 32. That's 12% because of the spending's out of control, and the rest is the cost of the bank bailouts, which has just been escalating out of control. And to come in with these talk of huge losses for bondholders in the middle of all this, when people are really, really jittery about Ireland anyway, either it was a terrible mistake, which I think is most likely, or it was deliberate. They knew this would have this effect, and they're trying to bring matters to a head because they don't like the way this is all developing.
This gets very interesting because it's, you know, the implications into the financial markets, whether it's the currency markets, the stock and bond markets globally. We've been given the impression by Wall Street that the worst is behind us and that sort of the credit contraction of 2008 was as bad as it could possibly get in this generation, sort of a once in 100 or 200 year event. Fortunately, we've got 100 to 200 years now before we experience anything like it again. But it seems like the ingredients are there to bake quite something. Interesting might be the wrong word.
I mean, they tackle the liquidity problem, but I mean, the underlying solvency problem has not gone away. These countries accumulated far too much debt, and it's still sitting on the books. And indeed, the debt load has actually increased in many of these cases. It's been switched to some degree onto the hands of the sovereign states, but it's sort of still there. And in the worst cases, in around the Eurozone periphery, it's over 300% of GDP, Ireland, Portugal, as it is, indeed it is in the United States. I mean, the problem over the last 50, 60 years is the aggregate debt level crept up and up and up, up and up to, you know, above the 300 line, which actually is exactly where it got to in the United States in the late 1920s. And essentially, once you let that happen, you're going to have a massive deleveraging crisis, and it's pretty much unavoidable. You can do it sort of slowly, which I'm generally in favor of. I'm not in favor of the absolute cold turkey approach because I think that's too traumatic and it destabilizes political systems.
Totally destabilizing. Yep. Yeah.
But you're going to have to do it, and you have to do it gradually. Now, you know, I favored the Federal Reserve's quantitative easing the first time around because I thought, you know, at that time you just needed to stabilize the system. Buy time for the players to start sorting out some of the basic problems. But I don't favor the second round because I think they're trying to avoid the necessary task of deleveraging. I just think they're trying to sort of pretend they can wriggle out of the pain. You can't wriggle out of the pain. Once you've created that debt load, you know, you're going to have to deal with it. And you're going to have to purge it. And you can try and sort of, you know, disguise it through inflation. But then you're also seriously distorting the system and seriously doing damage to people. You're slightly changing who the victims are. I think it's wrong to try and force up the inflation rate to devalue that debt away. I don't think you should go into deflation. I just think you should steer a narrow course between the Scylla of inflation and the Charybdis of deflation for many, many years until you've gradually brought the debt level down the hard way, the old-fashioned way, through a purge and paying it back at a lower economic growth rate until you've righted the ship. The Fed's trying to avoid that. They still seem to think. They argued during the boom that it's not the job of the central bank to intervene to stop these asset bubbles. They can come in safely and clean up afterwards. Ben Bernanke said that specifically. And they're now trying to justify their own ideology. They're saying, well, yes, trying to prove that they were right, you can still do it painlessly. Well, you can't do it painlessly. They oversaw an unsustainable and very damaging bubble. And I'm afraid this is no choice but to go suffer the consequences of that for probably 15, 20 years until we've dealt with it. And that applies in the United States. It applies in equally in Europe. And in many respects, the problem was worse in Europe because of the nature of the debt bubbles in Southern Europe, reached even more extreme excesses.
But the parts that are again, very similar in the United States is that we continue to have a solvency issue there, particularly in our banks. And as you say, that the hard but necessary work that needs to be gotten to once the system is stabilized, that of liquidating bad debts, has never gotten into swing at all. And so we still have as much of an issue in terms of instability as we had a few years ago, with a few dollars, literally just a few dollars, being shifted onto the Fed balance sheet. But if you look at the vast majority of bad debts, they still sit on bank balance sheets. And you're looking at insolvency issues far and wide in the banking community if we begin that liquidation or sort of mark-to-market process. There was something that we talked about this last week, which was basically in the context of a fiat money system, a completely unhinged system, what we've had globally since 1914, the incidence of currency crises has gone up dramatically, roughly 10 to 15 fold, according to Barry Eichengreen and Michael Bordeaux. But a 10 to 15 fold increase in the incidence of currency crises where there is what Otmar Issing had described in our interview with him a number of months back, asymmetric banking. Support for the markets on the one hand, but an unwillingness to allow for an unwind on the other. Asymmetric banking of any kind, and in this case, a very asymmetric approach to currencies. It's difficult for me, Ambrose, to see this ending painlessly as much as I would prefer it to. And I'm curious to know, as we come to some conclusions today, what your advice may be, very pragmatically. I mean, if you take stock, and I realize you, this is not investment advice, that's not the purpose of this, but as you reflect on this period of time, you've spent a lot of time in Brussels. You understand the guts of this beast. What are you thinking, not just as an analyst, but personally? What keeps you awake at night, and what would you consider doing differently in this particular period of time than you would have, say, 5, 7, 10 years ago?
Right. Now, I mean, this week, you know, obviously it's been the Irish crisis escalating out of control, and now, as of today, as we talk, the IMF and EU inspectors are now in Dublin going through the books. It's happened, you know, after 90 years of the Irish Free State, almost the final humiliation, and they're having to hand over the sovereignty. It's quite a desperate moment. There seems to be a view amongst the EU authorities and many of the banks and so forth that once you've got Ireland to accept the rescue, you've done a deal, you calm the markets, you calm the bond spreads, come back in again, we're back to normal. I think that's completely misguided. They're seeing it as sort of a contagion problem. And there is a contagion problem because it was beginning to affect Portugal and Spain quite seriously. But the problem is much, much deeper than that. You know, Portugal essentially, and it's a lovely country, but it's essentially insolvent. It's in worse shape than Ireland. The chronology of this is slightly different. The particular problems are slightly different. But you know why? But it's actually fundamentally in worse shape. It's the reliance of its foreign banks on external funding is huge. It's got a vast current account deficit, over 10% of GDP, unlike Ireland, which is coming back into surplus, by the way. So it isn't a contagion issue. These are parallel bankrupt countries, essentially. And so if they think that this is all going to go away now, just as they thought it was all going to go away after the Greek rescue, they're completely wrong. It's not. And actually, I don't think they're going to have the same kind of grace time. I think the Portugal thing is going to erupt very, very soon. Probably there's an immediate follow-on. And I would add further, the way that the rescue fund works is like climbers on a glacier who are all roped together. Each time one of these countries needs a rescue, it's like somebody slipping on the glacier and falling and hanging on the rope. And there's a smaller and smaller group of solvent states holding the line. So you've got more and more people dangling on the line and less solvent states holding the line. So it's an unworkable arrangement. And so if you have an Irish and a Portuguese rescue, you're probably talking about $200 billion via euros. But Spain is having to contribute to this. So it's depleting Spain's public finances, making it worse. Now, what happened to Spain is a rescue, probably for $300-400 billion. Then you're talking about $500-600 billion, and then Italy's public finances get depleted because Italy has to pay for that. As soon as you think it through, it's not viable. And they created this rescue fund, this 750 billion euro shock and awe safety net with the IMF they created in May. They did it kind of, they cobbled it together on the spur of the moment, thinking their bluff would never be called. Simply announcing the existence of this safety net would be enough. And now, to their horror,
they've got to pay up.
It is being called. Ireland's calling it right now, and Portugal is just a step away. And this is the ultimate nightmare in Europe, that this thing just, they have to deliver, and then people find out this fund doesn't really exist. It doesn't exist in the sense that there is limited tolerance and patience in Germany and the Netherlands to fund these bailouts. And the more this goes on, the more that's going to be completely exposed. It'll become clear that the German public will not accept any further bailouts and will not go beyond Spain. Absolutely, definitely not. And then you have a global systemic crisis. That's the danger point. Because as soon as people realize that they don't actually have the means to contain this, then you have a global crisis. Now, in my view, the only thing that can save it, in the sense that I use save in inverted commas, because it's not really saving it, but it's, is if the European Central Bank just prints massive amounts of money. It does what Ben Bernanke's doing. Just go and print a trillion and just do it. Okay, then you can cushion this thing. They can go in there and buy every bond in Ireland. They can buy every bond in Portugal. They can buy every bond in Spain. they could just take these countries out of the debt markets. They have the ability to do that. Whether they will, no, they won't. Politically, it's too contentious. So,
well, and just politically contentious, we know their history. They know their history even better. And there's something that deep in the fiber of the German public has been marked by the dual hyperinflations of the last century. So, I mean, what may be an expeditious or pragmatic route is not really on the table in the sense that it goes against literally every fiber in their being. I sat at a table just a few nights ago, and the story was retold about a family who had loaned, this was in Germany, a town just south of Stuttgart, family loaned a neighbor enough gold to build their house. And in the context of the hyperinflation, that loan was paid back with a single chicken. There's something that, again, stays with, this is now two generations away from that, and that story is still alive in that family because inflation leaves a very nasty and permanent psychological scar.
I agree, and the kind of drastic actions of monetary inflation will be needed, in my view, to save Southern Europe is incompatible with German monetary philosophy. And so whatever saved the South will cause the North to leave. You cannot bridge these two positions. That's so ultimately, I don't really see how they're going to get out of this. And
that's the point I come back to is, you know, the issue of who goes first, who realizes the inevitable, wherein Spain says, in spite of our gratitude, and as you point out, there is a tremendous appreciation for what happened, you know, with the inclusion into the euro. A tremendous amount of goodwill extended to the EU. But on the other hand, every country understands that the best way to alleviate debt is to depreciate through inflation. So an easier course perhaps for Spain is not to see a political revolution, but to simply drop from the EU, gain control of the monetary levers once again, and devalue, because the Germans certainly aren't going to do that for them.
I think Spain's further away from doing that than Germany is. I mean, I think it's more likely that Germany would sort of somehow trigger the crisis. But Germany has to decide what is their ultimate purpose. They've made a huge political investment for the last 50, 60 years rebuilding the European order. And they've done so, in my view, in a very enlightened and generous way. I mean, you know, some people say it's self-interested. Well, yes, it is. But I think they have really been very idealistic. They have to decide whether they're going to safeguard that investment. Are they going to cause a massive political and strategic crisis in Europe, cause the whole thing to disintegrate, and then be hated and blamed? Do they want that? And clearly, a lot of the German political class do not want that. So they're going to have to choose between, do they want financial and monetary stability, or do they want to safeguard their strategic investment in Europe? And in German foreign policy, and in the rehabilitation of Germany after the war, and everything that means. Now, which are they going to choose? I don't know.
If the German political class is insulated enough from the democratic process, then it looks like they would probably lean towards the building of political capital, even if it's at the expense of the euro and currency stability. But if they can emerge in a unique way 5 years from now, 10 years from now, even more central to every European country, and they paid an extreme price, but in fact consolidated political power, is that of interest to them? The question is, can the political class deal with the fallout of that, you know, in local elections? Certainly we saw some pushback in Westphalia this last year in a vote which would have indicated that at a social level, no, the individual Germans are going to vote against that kind of a sacrifice. But again, so can the German political class stay insulated from a decision that would concentrate political power in Germany over the next 10 to 20 years?
They will bend over backwards to try and maintain their strategic partnership with France and not to let that break up. And the difficulty is, you know, what's France going to do if these southern countries start, you know, getting into just completely just uncontrollable crises? And I think we're in an area now where it's, and I might add that the French banks are kind of joined at the hip with the Italian public debt. I mean, they own, I think, 480, French banks have 480 billion euros of exposure to Italian public debt alone. I mean, they're completely interwoven. So French are not going to let the Italians go. So I just don't see how you can square anything. I don't see, you know, the Germans thought they could sort of carve away a kind of Carolingian core of Europe and let the southern Mediterranean countries go. I just don't see how you can resolve this in any shape or form. Whatever solution you look at, you can't see how it works. You know, and they were warned that the euro would lead to this kind of crisis. Their own economists in the European Commission warned them exactly that this would occur. They said that the currency unions, you know, they don't eliminate the risk. They simply switch the exchange risk into default risk because the countries, they can't devalue anymore. So if they get into trouble, they have to default. So the kind of crisis we're now facing was entirely predictable. They were warned about it. The view amongst the fathers of the euro, Jacques Delors and people like this in Brussels in the early 90s was, well, any crisis will be a beneficial crisis. It'll allow us to achieve our greater aim, which is to accelerate the pace of European integration, move towards a full fiscal union, do the things we can't do now because of national sovereignty and governments refusing to give up their powers, and it'll all work to our advantage. Well, we've reached that point now. We're putting it to the test, and we'll find out whether it creates a move towards a full-fledged European union and fiscal union and debt union in which Germans take on in perpetuity the debts of southern Europe, or whether in fact it'll just cause the whole thing to blow up. It'll backfire massively. This great historical gamble 20 years ago will just simply blow up in their face. And this is the moment, I think, that we're on the cusp of it right now.
Any final thoughts in terms of the implications into the currency markets?
It would be hard to be too enthusiastic about the prospects for the euro in this environment.
It sure almost seems that the euro is mispriced at roughly 140. I mean, with these pressures mounting, it certainly has lost a few points, but nothing to reflect. I mean, as you said, with this transition into corporate risk sharing, you move from exchange risk to default risk. The price of the euro does not reflect potential default in any of these countries.
Well, I don't give any kind of market advice. Clearly, there's a tendency to price the euro as if it was a proxy for the old German Deutschmark and then forget that it's actually also a proxy for the lira and the peseta and the escudo. And if you start factoring in the crisis in southern Europe, clearly, you know, it's not going to remain anywhere near the level it's at now. I think it'll fall to parity, actually, against the dollar. I think despite all the problems with the dollar, I think we're going to have a quite a massive dollar rally against the European currencies. And to some degree, a very sharp fall in the euro would actually help the eurozone. It might be one of the things that could help rescue it. For example, countries like Ireland and the very leverage to the exchange rate, external exchange rate against the dollar and sterling, that might help Ireland get out of its problems. So, you know, I don't see that as a bad thing for Europe in these circumstances. It needs a weaker Europe. The problem is Germany does not need a weaker euro. Germany's doing fine. It's exporting like crazy. It's doing incredibly well in Asia and Russia and China. So again, you just hit this basic incompatibility of the needs of the South and the needs of the North. One needs a weaker currency, the other needs a stronger currency. I don't know how we're going to bridge that. You know, to answer your question finally, you know, what do I think is going to happen? I don't think the European crisis has played out. I think it's going to be very, very destabilizing for many, many, many months. And it's going to be traumatic, and it's going to call into question the sort of stability of the global system. Nor do I think that the Chinese banking and credit bubble has played out. And I think there are a couple more pulses to all of this before we clear the great excesses of the last 50, 60 years, before we have a final, you know, lance the boil. All three boils, the American property bubble, the European sovereign bubble, and the Chinese credit bubble, and you lance all those three boils, you know, then we can clear the dust and we can reboot.
I just found myself instinctively grabbing for my parachute cord and realized I didn't have one on, which was unfortunate. Where we may need a couple. Well, thank you so much for joining us and enjoy the conversation. Glad you're back safe from China. And it seems funny that I'm in Brussels in your old stomping ground, but next time I'm through London, perhaps we can sit and have a cup of tea.
Very good. Thank you very much. Bye.
Well, David, the insights from Ambrose have always been very, very clear and focused. The thing that's amazing right now is that he's brought it down to two points, that the North has a certain mindset and the South has a certain mindset. The North is the creditor. The South is the debtor. And those are incompatible. That's a scary thought.
Kevin, it reminds me of stepping into an environment like a corporate turnaround where the first thing you need is a very clear appraisal of the issue, which I'm not sure that those here in Brussels are getting. They haven't wanted to accept, just as our fiscal and monetary authorities in the states have not wanted to accept just how bad things are, how out of kilter balance sheets have gotten, and how devastating a debt deleveraging could and may in fact be immediately in front of us. But once you've identified what the issue is, you need the right people in place to execute a plan. And again, I think this is where we're dealing with politicians and more than politicians, particularly when we're talking about the EU, we're talking about an entrenched bureaucracy. We're talking about a system, Kevin, that is driven by the largesse of bureaucracy. And these are people who don't make clear business decisions on a day-by-day basis, a strategic decision based on a limited amount of capital. They're used to infinite dollars feeding an infinite machine, and this is the problem. They're now finding that they have finite dollars, and the machine is not quite as strong as they thought. So this will be an interesting, whether it's weeks, months, or years, as we look at the world ahead and the implications for Europe, the Eurozone, the Euro as a monetary unit. And as we mentioned last week, Kevin, the potential for a revolution in monetary regimes.
Yeah, well, David, from the conversation that we had with Otmar Issing a few months ago, you know, his hope was that this system would work. He saw the fallibilities of the system that Ambrose brought up this conversation. But it seems at this point, this cusp moment is coming, and for Ireland anyway, for their sovereignty, the jig is up. You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney and our guest today, Ambrose Evans Pritchard. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or just give us a call, 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.